I have not been humiliated like this for as long as I can remember. It was a weird feeling and a hard feeling to just be totally, utterly humiliated.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about their failures and what they learn from them. I'm your host, Ozan Varol. Today's guest on the show is Tiago Forte. Tiago is one of the world's foremost experts on productivity. He writes and speaks on how knowledge workers can revolutionize their personal effectiveness using technology, and has taught more than 20,000 people around the world through his online courses and live workshops. Tiago's signature online course called Building a Second Brain has been taken by more than 1,000 people from more than 60 countries. You can learn more about Building a Second Brain at buildingasecondbrain.com. In the interview, Tiago and I discuss how Tiago quit his consulting position in Silicon Valley to pursue a career as an entrepreneur, what you can do to prepare for being an entrepreneur, if you're thinking about that yourself, why Tiago's first business venture was a massive success, how that massive success was then followed by a colossal failure, and the lessons that Tiago learned from that failure, how Tiago went about validating his next business idea, the Building a Second Brain course, before launching it, and why showing your failures and vulnerability can actually make you more appealing, something known as the beautiful mess effect. Before I play the interview, if you'd like to keep in touch with me, your host, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Contrarian, which goes out every Thursday to nearly 14,000 people and shares an article that I wrote that week, along with recommendations for books, other articles, tools, quotes, really anything that challenges conventional wisdom and helps you see the world a little bit differently. You can sign up for that by heading over to weeklycontrarian.com. And if you sign up, you'll also get my free ebook, The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Tiago Forte as much as I did. Thanks as always for listening. Tiago, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ozan. Great to be here.
So excited to speak with you. Let me begin by giving a shout out to our mutual friend, Kay Hee, for introducing us and allowing you to appear on the show. I'd love to begin with a little bit of a background. So take us back, please, to when you were a consultant in Silicon Valley. You decided to leave the corporate world and start your own business. I'd love to hear about your thought process. Why did you decide to leave?
It was a few things kind of that intersected all at the same time. I mean, it's a huge decision. It's a big decision to kind of leave one path to another. I no longer think that it has to be that black and white, but at the time I did. And that was kind of my first sort of normal job. I had done a few things in the nonprofit world, like served in the Peace Corps for a couple of years. I'd worked, done an internship in microfinance, and then worked at the Apple Store in college. This was kind of like my first like full-time professional, you know, post-college job. One thing was the workload. Consulting is a grueling business. There's few sources of leverage. It's kind of just like raw, you know, mental effort. You know, you kind of always have to bring your best thinking to work every single day, which is quite taxing. And I did that for 18 months and just thought, you know, if I'm going to spend my life this way, I wanted to at least be for my benefit. One of the precipitating factors right in that period, this was like mid-2013, was actually my first annual performance review. It was kind of like my first complete year. And I sat down with one of the managers. It was a pretty small team. And by the way, it's a boutique consulting firm based out of Paris, French company that does like innovation consulting. So they, you know, learn about cutting edge topics like drones or self-driving cars or smart cities or cryptocurrency. And then they sort of package up that knowledge for corporate clients and then do everything from, you know, events to product development to marketing consulting, kind of using that knowledge they've gained from research in all sorts of different ways, but working mostly for kind of the biggest companies in Europe and the US. I remember this review, sitting down and you know, getting really good marks, really good, you know, like collaboration or communication, whatever the metrics were, was like really solid. And having really just positive comments. You know, you work well with your peers, you're responsible, all the that kind of stuff that you hope to hear. Towards the end, I remember my manager saying, a couple more years of this and you could be promoted from a junior project manager, which I was at the time, to a project manager. And then a couple of years more, you could even be a senior project manager. And then after a few years of that, you might even one day be a project director. And I just looked at her and I could see she thought she was just giving me this enticing road to walk. And I just could see it was like that, those scenes in the movies where like the lens zooms out, you know, and I could just see like my 20s and 30s basically passing by, working so hard just to kind of climb this corporate ladder that was not that interesting to me. I think I left within a month or two of that because everything I was doing started to seem like I was never really going to see the full benefit. And it was all part of a game and a career ladder that I just had no interest in. I was more interested in optimizing for learning and for freedom and for pursuing interests and goals that I wanted to myself and being self-employed. I thought that would have taken years, but the series of factors kind of came together and I just kind of went for it.
What a great story. And I love that the precipitating factor here, or the event that tipped the scales, was an annual performance review where you got really good marks. It's just that your manager happened to literally sketch this corporate ladder for you, and you weren't happy with what you saw. But, you know, a lot of people in your position, especially, I mean, it wasn't like you weren't doing well at your job. You were doing really well, and you have what sounds like a really amazing firm doing really interesting work. Even if people are sort of dissatisfied at what their life might be 5, 10, 15 years down the road, and this idea of climbing the corporate ladder doesn't sound appealing to them, it's still really hard to give up the safety and security of a paycheck, a monthly paycheck, to then strike out on your own. Did you think about that? I mean, what was going on through your head as you contemplated that possibility of leaving a secure job to enter the insecurity and uncertainty of starting your own business?
I think there were a few mitigating factors. One was having a lot of entrepreneurs in my family. There's sort of this conversation these days about whether, you know, being able to be an entrepreneur is a sign of privilege, with evidence on both sides. People do it coming from privilege and they do it coming from really difficult circumstances as well. I kind of had a combination where most of the, especially men in my family, are either self-employed or entrepreneurs of some kind. And it does help because you just see models. You know, you see models of what does a self-employed person look like? What do they do? Like, how do they make decisions? What kind of lifestyle do they have? How do they deal with uncertainty? You need models like that. And actually, even with that family background, at the time I was staying. Actually, so when I came to San Francisco to get this to start this job, I stayed at an Airbnb, a room that I rented for a couple months, and became friends with the owner. Her name was Lisa, and she was an entrepreneur. She had a business doing interior design for startups. And I remember just observing her. You know, I'd come to Silicon Valley in the land of entrepreneurs, but I would watch her, like, oh, okay, so what does she do in the morning? Like, does she like go right to work? Does she, you know, when does she have meetings? Like, how much time does she take off? How much money does she seem to have? Like,
yeah.
I was like, anthropologist. And then it was only, I remember this feeling like after a couple of months of like, you know what? I can do what she does. You know, she's not a superhuman. She works hard, but she also plays hard. She, you know, definitely takes weekends and takes a lot of time off. I kind of do that. You need to sort of see someone that you can emulate. This is one of the great undervalued things about Silicon Valley, is it's one of the, maybe the only place on the world where the average person is like that.
So to go back to the question was about what was going on through your head when you decided to take the leap, and what factors essentially influenced your decision and made you feel secure, or as secure as possible in deciding to take the leap. And you mentioned that, one, there were self-employed men in your family, and so you could look to them as role models. And then also you happened to be at this Airbnb where you had easy access to an entrepreneur. And that's so important because it normalizes being an entrepreneur and makes you feel more safe in taking this leap that somebody else that you know well has already taken. Were there any other factors that influenced your decision?
One was that I wasn't making much money. And I think that's actually kind of important. It's like, I don't know. I would really love to believe that entrepreneurship is open to anyone of any age, any life situation. But I was at this time maybe 26, and I've noticed some of my friends who have followed a more traditional path, you know, once they did get those titles and those promotions and especially those salaries, you know, it's one thing to walk away from a 40K a year job in San Francisco, which is like bare minimum survival. I think that's what I was making at the time. It's a very different thing to walk away from a 100K job, to go from that to zero on day one of your new thing. And then having kids and a wife and spouse and all those things, that's a whole nother level. So I talk to a lot of young people, and I encourage them, you know, if they show some risk tolerance and some desire to build something from scratch, something their own, I encourage them to not think in terms of like entrepreneurship as like a career path they have to prepare for. I really think there's not really any preparation besides doing it. And the further you walk along the career path, the more you kind of get stuck on it. And then the last thing I would say is I had a project in mind. You know, I didn't quit my job, go home and sit on the couch, watch TV. I had a very specific thing I wanted to do, which is to build an online course. And I remember the last few months of my job, I had just discovered this website called Skillshare, which was one of the original ones at the time. I'd taken a class on Ruby on Rails, not even really finished it, but just kind of seen like, oh, so there's this new thing called online courses. And they're successful. Like you could see, you know, the course cost $25 and it had been taken by like 10,000 people. And so I did the math and thought, okay, this guy's making a living doing this. And then I thought about my skills. And I guess this is the serendipitous part, is I had done a lot of teaching. In the Peace Corps, I had taught mostly English. Before that, I had taught English in South America. So I kind of was comfortable teaching. And then online courses gave me the channel, gave me the medium. And so I left the job, and just in 2 or 3 weeks threw myself into this new project. And I think within about a month of quitting, I had published this course on this productivity method called GTD. And I definitely, you know, I was lucky, and then that course was very successful. It was partly also I just took his best-selling book, which was sort of validated, and I converted it directly into a course. I was naive enough to not know that you're not really supposed to do that. and that course was really, really what launched my business. And it's still around to this day. 6 years later, it still sells. People still buy that course, which is such a testament to information products, honestly, that they can just be online as a one-time thing you've done and sell for years and years.
That's amazing. And the fact that it took you just, you said 1 month from idea to execution?
Yeah, I mean, I had to, because I didn't even have a month of savings.
So that's sort of a constraint that fueled the fire, so to speak, and prompted you to move very quickly. And the course was super successful, and it still continues to be successful. That's amazing. Now, you did mention when we were exchanging emails that you've also had so many failures in starting your own business. We kick things off with a success story of the GTD course. When you look back in starting your own business and building it, what failures come to mind as being particularly valuable, and what makes them valuable?
The first 3.5 years, really, yeah, 3.5 years of being self-employed were pretty much living on the edge, not just financial sustainability, but just like any sense that I knew what I was doing. I did have that early success. That was nice. And I had different successes along the way, but I bounced back and forth between trying different things, and they all failed in certain ways. So with the self-paced courses, I did the GTD one and kind of had this unexpected success. Then I followed it up about a year later with the habits course. And I remember having that first success, my ego got so huge. I really thought it was all due to me. You know, oh, I'm just so brilliant. Anything I just throw together in the form of a course is going to do well. Disregarding the fact that, you know, I had completely taken the ideas of David Allen, and he had spent, you know, 30 years developing these ideas. And so my habits course, I remember I took my time. I did all my research. I did everything the quote unquote right way, instead of in a 3 week mad sprint. You know, I paid a professional video crew to do the video. I had, you know, I took marketing courses to figure out how to do marketing. I spent all this time on the design, and that course failed so miserably. It was really because I did not validate the ideas. You know, I basically did the caveman method of holing up in my apartment for a few months and not telling anyone and sort of doing it in secret. And then, you know, investing all this time buying the URL, creating all the materials. And what I discovered months later through finally getting feedback was that the whole framing of the course was wrong. And even the title was completely wrong. I had called it Design Your Habits. And what I discovered months later is nearly everyone saw that title and thought, oh, this is for designers. Very natural assumption. Design your habits. Well, who designed things? Designers. All the people that would be my audience disregarded it and didn't even consider it. And then the few designers that took it were like, this isn't about design at all. So that means, you know, no customer testimonials, no word of mouth. I don't think I even made my money back.
If you could go back and do this all over again, how would you go about validating the idea?
That is what I did for the next course, which is called Building a Second Brain. And when I said for 3.5 years, I was kind of struggling, that's because it was about 3.5 years after I left my previous job that I launched Building a Second Brain, which really has become my sort of what I'm known for, what I'm dedicated to. It's like my thing, my method. So this is a great contrast because I was so determined to not repeat that failure that the testing, the validation process was stretched out over like 2 years. It started with an article. I wrote this post called Tagging is Broken, where it was a rant. Actually, one day I just, you know, wasn't part of my planned projects. I saw this like number one article on Medium, which was all in favor of tagging. And I hate tags. It's just like a personal pet peeve. And I just sat down and in one sitting just wrote this rant, just ranting on how much I hate tags.
If I can pause you there for just a second, for members of the audience who are not familiar with what a tag might be, would you be able to provide a brief explanation?
The field that we're in is idea management. So the ideas you come across, you know, you have yourself or you encounter, how do you save them? In my methodology, we use devices, we use computers. Then how do you organize those ideas? How do you, you know, put them into different groupings? Then how do you use your ideas to make things, to create blog posts, to, you know, execute your projects, to reach your goals, to put on events, whatever it is. One of the big questions in this field is how to organize your knowledge, how to organize your ideas. And there is a group of people that likes tags. You know, you put all, like you, it's like a tag is like a little label. It's like you have, say, your notes on a book and you put tags that say like cognitive science, learning, productivity, labels that describe what this note is about. And I don't think that works. And so I did this rant and I was just shocked at the response. You know, it's a very nerdy, esoteric thing. And yet for a certain kind of person, that is a very hot issue. And I got this bunch of response and I thought, wow, okay, there's something here. And then, of course, the main thing that people said was, well, okay, smarty pants, how do we do it then? If tags don't work, it's easy to criticize, but what is your proposal? And so then I had to go, oh, shoot, now I have to actually, you know, propose something. I went through and kind of organized my thoughts and wrote this post, put it on Medium, got really great response. I had essentially no following at that time, you know, a couple hundred Medium followers maybe. So I didn't really realize how interesting this thing was until Evernote contacted me. Apparently, they saw this post.
And what was the name of that post?
How to use Evernote for your creative workflow. And they said, can we republish? And I said, sure. They republished it. And, you know, there was some good response. But actually, it wasn't until a year later that a friend of mine messaged me and said, have you seen the comments on that post? And I said, I didn't even know there were comments. And I went back and there was just the most fantastic. Every comment was like, this was life-changing. This is the best article on productivity I've ever read. I've been using Evernote for 5 years, but I never knew how to use it. And that was really the moment where I said, okay, there's something here. And I started the process of making it into a course. It was like several attempts at putting something out there and people saying, this is really, really good before I even, you know, thought of the idea of making it into a course.
I love the idea that like you went after a very niche market, you know, unintentionally so perhaps, but people tend to, when they start a business or launch an online course, to try to go for the masses and try to find an idea that's going to appeal to everyone and their cousin to be able to sell as much as possible. But your idea stemmed from an article called Tagging is Broken, which is so esoteric. And I love that because the people with whom that message resonates are going to be such diehard fans of what you're building that they're going to want to tell everybody about it.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, there was a failure in there too. During this 2-year period, as the idea of an idea management course, which I would have never thought of, as it was slowly occurring to me, I tried corporate training. And this was a reaction. It's like a pendulum. I did my second self-paced course and I thought it failed. Instead of the ego inflation, I had the opposite reaction, which was I'm worthless.
Yeah. So you went from one extreme to the other.
Exactly. Both extremes. And I just thought, like, I made it mean something about myself. I thought, oh, I just got lucky that one time. I guess I'm just not a good teacher. I'm not a good content creator. I can't do this. And I also made it mean something about self-paced courses. I thought, oh, self-paced courses are actually not a good idea. It's a dead end. It's not going to go anywhere. Self-paced courses are lame. And I went to the opposite extreme. I said, okay, well, how do I actually make a living? I wanted to avoid going back to work at all costs. I thought, well, corporate training seems to be profitable. And I started doing just workshops. This had its own testing process. It started off as a free workshop on design thinking that I did at a local co-working space. People liked it. They said they wanted more, started getting some business cards, and this led to corporate training. And so for about a year and a half, I focused on doing, you know, half day, full day, or 2-day workshops for corporate groups. It's funny, on the surface, it was very successful. I had some interesting kind of introductions in Silicon Valley. So my first clients were like Genentech, which is the most profitable company in the US per employee. They invest a ton in their employees. I did them for Toyota. I did the Inter-American Development Bank, which is a governmental organization. So it was definitely successful. And the corporate training is very profitable. I mean, a standard pricing model is for a full day of training is like $15,000 to
$25,000.
Wow. So very profitable. Just there's one little issue, which is I hated it. I learned in that period that not everything you're good at is something you love.
And why did you hate it? Because, you know, at least at the surface, teaching an online course, whether it be self-paced or live, virtually, doesn't seem all that different from doing a day of corporate training where you're teaching corporate executives about an idea.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's what I thought at first, but I think it was a few things. I think first it was sort of the kind of people that were there. Most of my 20s had been spent, you know, like I said, in the Peace Corps. I was just really a bleeding heart do-gooder. I was in the Peace Corps. Before that, I was in microfinance. Before that, I was teaching in the slums of Rio de Janeiro, where I was studying abroad. Like I've always really had a heart for service and just really loved serving in every way I can. That's just really been very gratifying to me. And then I found myself, you know, in these corporate training rooms among who are really people who are the most productive people in the world already.
Sure.
You know, these are ultra high performing people in the world's most high performing knowledge organizations. And you know, I would give them some interesting things, some interesting ways of looking at things and methods. But it was kind of like, I mean, it was serving the 1% of the 1%. And I didn't feel like I was actually making a positive impact on anyone that really needed it. But more than that, I think it was just incredibly draining. I'm a natural introvert. It's like I can, you know, do groups and do public speaking, but with training, at the very least, you're a half day, full day in front of people of being super high energy, super engaging, super out there. And I found that I would just like, after a day or especially 2 days of this, I would just be comatose. I would like go home and just sleep for like 2 days. The problem with training is it's your time. You're trading your time for your money, right?
Sure.
So you have to keep up quite a schedule. And trainers often, you know, will travel constantly. They'll have at least one training every week or do back-to-back trainings or all these things, be on a lot of phone calls, do a lot of speaking gigs to promote their services. And I just couldn't sustain. I would have to take like weeks to recover almost from these trainings. And it just wasn't sustainable. When I did Building a Second Brain, I came back to online courses, but in an interesting way, I sort of combined my experiences. You know, I was still doing an online course, so still doing all the content creation. But then instead of making it self-paced from day one, which I'd kind of learned that lesson, I got what I had learned from corporate training, like that speaking experience. And I did an online live course where it was online in that we were at our computers, but I was using the Zoom software to actually deliver each session live to a group of people in a cohort that would last about a month. And we would meet, you know, a couple times a week. And that was has been a fantastically successful model until today. In fact, I'm still doing, I did a cohort just earlier today. And it was a direct result of just combining the lessons from each of my previous failures.
You actually wrote before that some of your biggest failures from starting your own business became your best pieces of writing. How did you decide to write about your failures? Because as you mentioned before, you know, people tend to talk about their successes and not as much their failures. So what prompted you to decide to write about them? And did you have any hesitations about sharing those failures publicly?
I tried to define what I was doing exactly. Kind of the category I seemed to be falling into was productivity and self-improvement, which is a great category. You know, a lot of people spend a lot of time and a lot of money improving themselves. So I wrote this post early on about, I had joined a sailing club, the Cal Sailing Club out of the Berkeley Marina. I was learning to sail these small dinghies. And one day I had my dinghy docked. I was learning to do the rigging and I capsized. So like I'm sitting there in the dock and then just I get something wrong and the boat just goes right over. And so I'm sitting there like tied to the dock in the water. Everyone's kind of hanging around the dock and the marina. And people are just like just laughing so hard. Like just like, oh my gosh, this newcomer is just like not even out to sea yet. And he's capsized. And I remember walking away and it was like a scene from a movie. You know, like a kid movie where like all the people in the class are like pointing and laughing at you.
Right.
Like something out of a nightmare. And I just think like, wow, I have not been humiliated like this for as long as I can remember. It was a weird feeling and a hard feeling to just be totally, utterly humiliated. And this was just around the time I was starting my blog. So I had, you know, a few articles about productivity, which got, you know, mediocre kind of feedback. They were kind of mediocre, to be honest. And I wrote about this experience. I just wrote about what it feels like to be humiliated, what it feels like to fail in such a public way. And people really responded to it. You know, I think I posted it on Facebook and both friends and people I didn't know as well were like, wow, this was really meaningful. I really resonated with this. And it was writing about that sort of, I don't know if you would call it a failure or just a mistake, but I realized there was something about this field of self-improvement, that there was something really off-putting about just constantly writing about how great you are. You know, your perfect email system, the 5 top tips to be productive. Medium is full of these articles. It was around this time that I kind of decided to take a different path as a so-called productivity expert and to spend just as much time writing about those things as sort of the journey of personal growth and vulnerability and emotional intelligence and self-awareness, sort of it's like the underbelly of self-improvement that so often gets ignored. And that has been absolutely fundamental to my career. It's what I'm known for. It's what differentiates me. And it makes me a real human that people actually want to work with rather than this sort of like aspirational, like perfect archetype.
There's actually a name for what you're describing in psychology, which is the beautiful mess effect. This is a real thing, and I'll include some studies in the show notes. But exposing your vulnerability, your mistakes, your failures, counterintuitively perhaps, can make you more desirable, more interesting in the eyes of other people. I mean, we're used to sort of creating these perfectly curated portrayals of our lives to display on Instagram. But, you know, actually showing your vulnerabilities, your failures, your flaws can make you more desirable in the eyes of other people. So if you want an example, you can think of, I think it was Jennifer Lawrence, like tripping on the way to get her Oscar a few years ago when she won Best Actress. And that, you know, that one slip up made her much more relatable in the eyes of other people. There is a caveat, though. You actually have to establish your competence before you can reveal your failures. Otherwise, you risk damaging your credibility. But as long as you've established your credibility to begin with, exposing your failures and mistakes can be a good thing.
There's something there that's just also very encouraging, that you don't need to sort of perfect yourself in order to have something to share, in order to have something to contribute. You know, I talk to a lot of people that are trying to do some version of blogging or podcasting or becoming a thought leader or creating online courses. And they lay out this path for themselves, like I'll do A, B, C, D, E, all the way to Z, and then I'll sort of pull back the curtain and unveil my creation. When in fact, you want to share the journey. That journey of mistakes and failures and successes and everything is the teaching. That is the thing that people want to know about, because that's the journey they're going to have to go on. It's no use for them just seeing the peak at the very end, because that's not real to them. It's sharing the actual process that provides value.
Well, I think that's the perfect note to wrap this conversation up on. Tiago, thank you so much for joining us. If people want to learn more about you and check out your online course, Building a Second Brain, where can they find you online?
Yes. Yeah. Building a Second Brain is really my main focus these days. It has all my kind of best ideas about idea management, about productivity, about learning. And it's at buildingasecondbrain.com, where you can find all the details. And if you want to join me, you can sign up.
Excellent. And we will include a link to that in the show notes. Tiago, this was so much fun. Thank you again for making the time.
Thank you so much, Ozan. Really, really appreciate the opportunity.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.